Jimmy Carter has been programmed to proceed with all possible speed in dismembering what remains of our nation's defenses, while at the same time promoting public awareness of war tensions here and abroad. He is making the terrible mistake of thinking he is actually president. Meanwhile, longtime Rockefeller agent Walter Mondale stands ready and waiting for the moment, if and when, Jimmy Carter is erased from the scene. Mondale is by far the most powerful vice president in history next to Nelson Rockefeller, and he's in a position to pick up the reins of presidential power at a moment's notice. As for Nelson Rockefeller, he hasn't given up either. After a recent White House ceremony at which he was given an award, Rockefeller whispered to reporters as he left, "I'll be back." Jimmy Carter is functioning with a skeleton government at the present time here in Washington. Huge gaps remain deliberately unfilled in the Carter administration, such as the chairmanship of the United States Export-Import Bank. Normally, positions at EXIM Bank are among the most coveted plums in all of Washington, and yet, up to now, they remain unfilled. Why? Because, my friends, the Export-Import Bank is a peacetime operation, and it will be shut down when war comes, as it is planned to do. The Carter cabinet is a war cabinet, and the unprecedented measure was taken of rushing their confirmation hearings through Congress even before Carter took office. On hand to preside over America's final destruction in nuclear war I, are men of unchallenged qualifications for that task, such as Secretary of State Vance, Secretary of Defense Brown, and National Security Advisor Brzezinski, among others. These men were in the forefront of those who argued in favor of America's involvement in the disaster called Vietnam and helped guide the conduct of the war in such a way as to guarantee our defeat. Now, all they have to say about Vietnam is, quote, "We made a mistake," unquote. And with that, our country has been placed in their hands once again. We hear continually about government reorganization, but what does this really mean? For one hint, consider the fact that Brzezinski is on record as saying, quote, "The reality of our times is such that a modern society such as the United States needs a central, coordinating, and renovating organ which cannot be made up of 600 people," unquote. In other words, the United States Congress in its present form is obsolete and should be replaced by something else. Brzezinski, by the way, is a close neighbor and associate of David and Nelson Rockefeller's at Seal Harbor, Maine. And then there are the words of Andrew Young, appointed United States Ambassador to the UN by Carter. In that position, Young is charged with speaking for everyone in the United States. Yet he has said, quote, "Communism has never been a threat to me," unquote. Do words like that speak for you, my friends, or for your neighbors, or for any real American? But those words have been allowed to stand, and the man who said them is still the United Nations Ambassador. We are moving rapidly toward the introduction of the secret new Rockefeller Constitution for America, which I revealed and described in audio book tape released in July 1975. The plan is now to accomplish this as part of the scenario now underway to take over the country under threat of war. Even Carter's new CIA director, Admiral Turner, has been in contact with Carter for over 5 years, not about military matters, but governmental reorganization. And so, our unelected rulers continue to plan and scheme to take full advantage of the threat of war, and even nuclear war I itself, to destroy our way of life for their own purposes. The orchestrated pre-war buildup of tensions continues. In recent weeks, Western Europe has suddenly been highlighted as our nuclear age Dunkirk, because doubts are now being expressed that NATO forces there could withstand a surprise attack by the Warsaw Pact forces. And here at home, it is now officially acknowledged that the Soviet Union is shooting for military superiority over the West. Unofficially, some say they already have it. Worse yet, the Rockefeller-controlled CIA just happens to have been grossly underestimating the Soviet military buildup for a decade or more. Can you imagine? Suddenly, now we are told that the Soviet Union has been spending four times the previous CIA estimates for new weapons and military installations. The deliberate underestimates, which were arranged for years by Rockefeller insiders in the CIA, had just one purpose: to undermine any arguments about a serious Soviet threat, and thereby to ensure a decline in American military might. But now that nuclear war one is imminent, the CIA estimates can no longer make any difference in our preparedness. So now the estimates have suddenly been raised in order to demoralize us and convince us that defeat at Soviet hands is all but inevitable. Having arranged for our constitutional military forces to be weakened as much as possible, the CIA itself has become the most powerful military organization in the United States, a fact symbolized by the fact that the CIA will now be headed by four-star Admiral Turner, a Rockefeller insider who will retain his military rank. The CIA has been transformed into a combined super military and secret police controlled by persons loyal only to the Rockefeller brothers instead of the country as a whole. This is in complete violation of the original charter of the CIA and of the Constitution of the United States. 16 years after the establishment of the CIA at the instigation of David Rockefeller, former President Harry S. Truman expressed public regrets over having done so. On December 21, 1963, he wrote for the Washington Post, quote, "For some time I've been disturbed by the way the CIA has been diverted from its original assignment. It has become an operational and at times a policy-making arm of the government," unquote. Saying that he had never visualized, quote, "peacetime cloak and dagger operations," unquote, for the CIA, he added, and I quote, "This quiet intelligence arm of the president has been so removed from its intended role that it is being interpreted as a symbol of sinister and mysterious foreign intrigue and a subject for Cold War enemy propaganda," unquote. These words of President Truman were published just a month after an American president, John F. Kennedy, had been brutally removed from office by a successful CIA operation, as I revealed in Monthly Audio Letter Number 3 for August 1975. Already the CIA had broken free of presidential control, and a decade later, a CIA operation called Watergate replaced an elected president and vice president with appointees for the very first time in American history. Today, the United States is surrounded by 90 short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles planted by the Soviet Union within our own territorial waters. Our constitutional military services have been under presidential orders since October 1, 1976, not to remove them. And now that General Brown has been neutralized, no effort whatever is being made to do so. And the only real counter threat to these Soviet underwater missiles are the fleet of 14 awesome super missiles targeted on the Soviet Union from resting places deep in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. These undersea super missiles, as I revealed last month in Audio Letter Number 20, are not under normal military control, but are under direct Rockefeller command through their controlled CIA. Their purpose, as I have already explained, is not to prevent nuclear war one or even to retaliate when it comes. Their purpose is only to ensure that the Soviet Union abides by the joint Rockefeller-Soviet war plan to spare the Rockefeller brothers and their intimates while incinerating the rest of us. But as I revealed last month, the super-secret CIA missiles have begun deteriorating and leaking. One missile in the Pacific is totally disabled, and several others are leaking plutonium from their warheads into the surrounding waters, and probably are useless also. One of the leaking missiles which I mentioned last month is Atlantic Missile No. 8, which is located in the ocean about 290 miles southeast of Jacksonville, Florida. On February 7, 1977, just 2 weeks after I recorded Monthly Audio Letter No. 20, the beach near Jacksonville, Florida became the scene of a mystifying phenomenon. For no apparent reason, whales suddenly began beaching themselves in large numbers. Within a short time, over 120 whales beached themselves only to die there. That evening, NBC News reported that no autopsies were being performed on the whales, that this was to be left to the Smithsonian here in Washington. The next day, that story was retracted. But meanwhile, I know from my own sources that a high-ranking Smithsonian official who is a covert CIA agent went to Florida immediately to investigate and to make sure that the real cause of the whales beaching themselves did not become publicly known. One story the Smithsonian circulated as a possible explanation for the strange behavior of the whales was that some sort of parasites, caused perhaps by pollution, had caused the whales to lose their senses of depth and direction. But that, of course, does not explain why they would all have come ashore, out of their natural habitat, rather than wandering aimlessly at sea. And it explains even less what happened when some of the whales were towed off the beach and into the sea. In most cases, they unerringly headed straight for shore and beached themselves again. Even though death awaited them on the beach, they preferred that to their natural habitat of the sea. What you have not been told, my friends, is that a number of the whales were dissected, and in practically every case, their stomachs were completely empty. They were sick. But the real problem was not in their stomachs, but in their lungs, which were heavily contaminated with plutonium. A few days after the whales began beaching themselves, I was informed by my intelligence sources that the plutonium leakage from Atlantic Missile 8 had accelerated so rapidly that plutonium was now contaminating the Atlantic in a fan that touches the East Coast all the way from about halfway between Savannah and Brunswick, Georgia, southward almost to Daytona Beach, Florida. It was strongest in the middle, right where the whales came ashore near Jacksonville. My friends, I am not a marine biologist, and I don't know exactly how the whales got waterborne plutonium into their lungs. But the facts speak for themselves. Somehow it happened. And once there, the plutonium produced a fungus-like infection that interfered with their breathing. Finally, in desperation, the whales, which are mammals like you and me, began casting themselves onto the beach, gasping for air. By now, the whales have been collected and buried in the Gerwin Road landfill in Jacksonville, Florida, and forgotten by most as yesterday's news. But we would do well not to ignore the lesson of the beached whales, because now, like the whales, our drinking water in the United States now contains plutonium, too. The Soviet injections of plutonium into our atmosphere, which began last October 1976, have continued and in fact are now accelerating. And now fallout of this material has contaminated our own drinking water nationwide. It is invisible. It is tasteless, but it is there. As I reported last month, a dramatic increase in flu-like illness was to be expected all across America, thanks to the Soviet plutonium attack number 3, which took place in late December and early January. And now it's happening. Outbreaks of, quote, flu and flu-like illnesses, unquote, have been reported this month in at least 23 states. Perhaps you yourself have had a round of something lately that seems like the flu, yet may have seemed somehow different from flu you have had in the past. Or perhaps you have just noticed that something is going around. Even this recording was delayed 1 week by flu-like illnesses, which hit myself and some of my associates very hard. I wish I could tell you that the flu-like illness season were about over, but unfortunately the opposite is true. A fourth Soviet plutonium attack began this month on February the 3rd, involving 25 Soviet submarines. This time they were deployed along the entire West Coast, from Seattle to San Diego, and they injected plutonium into our atmosphere over a period of approximately 2 weeks. And now, just 3 days ago, on February 24th, a fifth Soviet plutonium attack on the United States has begun. This time, there are 30 Soviet submarines, again deployed all the way from Seattle to San Diego. Furthermore, I am now able to confirm that there is a weather modification aspect to the Soviet plutonium attacks. In the past year or so, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has issued warnings, so-called, that fluorocarbon propellants from household aerosol cans are damaging the ozone layer far up into the atmosphere. We have been warned that this could have very dangerous effects on our environment, and as a result, a trend away from aerosol spray cans is now underway. There may be some merit to that argument, but as usual, the EPA is merely seizing on a minor danger in order to cover up a far more real, immediate, and major threat. The means by which the plutonium is being dispersed into our atmosphere by the Soviet submarines is none other than by fluorocarbon propellants, discharging upward into the air at a steep angle. Each submarine in each attack exhausts huge quantities of fluorocarbon propellant in such a way that it is far more effective in damaging our ozone layer than millions of ordinary household aerosol cans in normal use. Even before the plutonium attacks began last October, my intelligence sources believe that fluorocarbon injections like this into our atmosphere were underway for some time. The introduction of the plutonium to these attacks last October was therefore an easy matter. But by other means also, weather modification activities by both the CIA and the Soviet KGB have been in progress for some time now for use in warfare. Because of these facts, I believe I should warn you about one thing which at this time I must label as conjecture. Normally, as you know, my policy is to tell you only those things which I have been able to confirm as established fact. But this time, I believe an exception is warranted. The timing, severity, and pattern of the huge winter storm that struck the north and east portions of the United States may well have been a massive pre-war weather modification experiment as a rehearsal for similar measures in nuclear war I. Had war broken out while those weather patterns persistent, large portions of the upper United States within the nuclear safe zone would have been immobilized by weather and therefore could have been spared from attack, seemingly for natural reasons. It may be that weather control is the key to the riddle of the nuclear safe zone, enabling it to escape attack, while the southern two-thirds of the United States, along with Alaska and Hawaii, endure a nuclear holocaust. If this is the case, then a future storm pattern that immobilizes the part of the United States above the 40th parallel could be the signal that a Soviet nuclear attack is imminent. I emphasize again that as of now, this is conjecture on my part. I have not been able to confirm it, but there are so many facts that point in this direction that I believe you should be warned of this possibility. The Rockefeller brothers, in any case, are doing everything in their power to hurry up Nuclear War I, so anything can happen. They are in a hurry because they want to make sure that the war takes place while enough of their super CIA missiles are still operational to provide an effective blackmail threat against the Soviets. But as for America's officially acknowledged fleet of intercontinental missiles, that is another matter. I have never revealed what went on when I saw General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in his Pentagon offices last September 16, 1976. But I think I should now mention just one item which has now acquired urgent new significance. One of the things I discussed with General Brown was the horrendous intelligence gap created by then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Because of this deliberate intelligence gap, General Brown and the Joint Chiefs have been denied crucial information needed to protect our country. In this connection, General Brown did not know about the super-secret nuclear safe zone negotiated for the private benefit of the Rockefeller brothers and their intimates by Kissinger. In fact, it seemed unbelievable because he pointed out the presence of several prime targets, namely ICBM installations inside the nuclear safe zone. But now, Jimmy Carter is pushing for those very ICBM sites to be shut down. That is the meaning of Carter's incredible order to General Brown at the Blair House meeting of January 12, 1977. And by that means, the Rockefellers plan to make the nuclear safe zone off limits to Nuclear War I attack. Topic number 3. Whatever the future holds for us, my friends, one thing is for sure. We are witnessing the end of an era. Politically, economically, socially, and spiritually, we are entering a time of tumultuous change. But the question still remains, change in what direction? Will this be the end of the era of destructive Rockefeller control over our lives? Or will we just sit back, wringing our hands, and let them succeed in their plans to snuff out the era of human freedom? Might we look forward to the new era of renewed respect for nature, as God in His wisdom created it? Or will we condemn ourselves by inaction to a suicidal era of ever-increasing destruction of our beautiful world, under the greedy exploitation of the Rockefeller cartel and their Soviet allies? Will the struggle that is being forced upon us lead us at last to a new dawning of the day of the individual? Or will we submit without struggle to the perfect equality of slaves in the Rockefeller Soviet world empire? My friends, it will take organized, dedicated, selfless action to sound the alarm and bring pressure to bear in time to turn away from total disaster for our land. But the hour is now so late. Where can we hope for this action to come from? If history is any guide, my friends, there is only one institution left. I have pointed out on previous occasions that what is happening in America today is a ghastly replay of what happened to Germany before World War II, with one difference. Those who brought Hitler to power as a pawn are themselves coming to power here in America. With this in mind, I will now read a very rare letter to you. for reasons which will become apparent, it will be safely stored away again under lock and key by the time you hear this recording. The letter, written by a distinguished churchman, is dated October 16, 1945, and is addressed to Dr. Albert Einstein. I will now read directly from the letter. My dear Dr. Einstein, I have seen you reported as having said, quote, "Being a lover of freedom, when the revolution came in Germany, I looked to the universities to defend it, knowing that they had always boasted of their devotion to the cause of truth. But no, the universities immediately were silenced. Then I looked to the great editors of the newspapers, whose flaming editorials in days gone by had proclaimed their love of freedom. But they, like the universities, were silenced in a few short weeks. Only the church stood squarely across the path of Hitler's campaign for suppressing the truth. I never had any special interest in the church before, but now I feel a great affection and admiration, because the church alone has had the courage and persistence to stand for intellectual truth and moral freedom. I am forced thus to confess that what I once despised, I now praise unreservedly." Unquote. Still continuing with the letter, "Would you be kind enough to let me know whether this represents your feeling now that hostilities have ceased? I should be very grateful to know how you feel about this now. With great admiration and every good wish, I am yours faithfully." And there follows the signature of the writer. Below, there is a postscript as follows, and I quote, "P.S. The statement is reported to have been made by you before the United States entered the war, and I thought possibly you might have had some occasion to change your opinion in the light of later developments. I naturally hope that you haven't." Unquote. The writer of this letter received it back with the following answer in longhand along the right-hand margin, and I quote, "The reproduction of my verbally given statement is essentially correct, and I have not changed my opinion concerning this point." Unquote. There follows the signature, A. Einstein. My friends, the churches in Nazi Germany recognized the onslaught of evil and stood up against it. Today, America faces the same evil, multiplied 1,000 times over. But where, oh, where are the churches today? Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.